Okay, well, assuming there are no questions about the issue of bargaining in good faith, you do notice, I'm sure, but if you haven't, you should remind yourself to look at the Racine and Laramie Limited note case on page 583, which is a kind of an effort to summarize the material in the chapter. I'm going to move on now from what is, as I said before, kind of new emerging doctrine, the notion of bargaining good faith, when do you have to, when you don't have to a very old doctrine. And it's a doctrine which you're going to find a little difficult as we try to make our way through it. And the trouble is that it's kind of unrewarding difficulty. And it's unrewarding primarily because, as I think the materials show you, the courts have been fundamentally unwilling to address the very real underlying dilemma. So we're going to try to keep our eye on that dilemma. So I'm going to start with it even before we talk about Mitchell versus Lath, which is a famous case in this area, which we all have to go through. On the one hand, there are some very good reasons why a contract system should encourage people to put their agreements in writing. Now, we'll see a week from tonight when we start looking at what kinds of contracts have to be in writing. There are a few. There are some important classes of contracts that have to be in writing. But for the most part, our system does not require writing. And I take it that it doesn't require writing because it was thought, first of all, just historically, we started at a time when very few people could write. And therefore, if we required a writing for all contracts, there wouldn't have been very many for a long time. But more than that, we don't expect that degree of formality in all of the kinds of commercial transactions in which we're all engaged every day. And so the statute of frauds has separated out some categories which, for historical reasons and sometimes even good reasons, we require to be in writing. But for the rest of it, we can do it orally. We contract orally all the time. Why should we encourage contracts in writing? Can you think of some of the reasons why it would be a good idea to encourage people to put things in writing?
To prevent fraud.
You know, fraud is not the first thing that would have occurred to me, but fraud, yeah.
To stop people from lying about what actually was agreed on?
Well, you have to be tell me a little bit more. Why does writing help that?
Well, because it takes away the he said, she said part of it. Like, if you have something actually in writing, then that's what you agreed upon. And
okay, but so that you're saying that there's a certain increase in clarity of what it is that is the agreement if it's in writing.
Right.
Yeah, something about writing which forces people to be a little clearer than they might be orally.
And to piggyback on that, if there's a dispute, at least you have something to go forward to the court with and they can interpret.
Okay. Yeah, when we have a disagreement between parties about what they agree to, at least rather than having said, well, he said this or she said that, instead we have a writing to go before the court for interpretation. Yeah,
expressed. Over time, the word gets forgotten, whereas on paper.
Good, yeah. Over time, exactly what words people use get forgotten, whereas the writing lasts longer.
To outline exactly what's included in the contract, all the elements of it?
Well, do you think that they are, is that a matter of remembering what they are, or is it a matter of encouraging the inclusion?
Because both sides review it, so you can say, okay, it includes this and this, and you'll get this.
Okay. So again, this is the idea that it's more likely to be a fuller, a more complete statement of the agreement than if people are doing it more casually, orally.
Over time, people change. New managers come in, and so there's a contract in place that's written, then it's not two people that just agreed to do something and they no longer work for those companies.
Yeah, and we've already read some cases like that where the people who are before the court are, if you will, second or third generation in terms of the particular transaction.
Also, having in writing like encourages people to think about things before they enter into the agreement.
Okay, yeah. One of the things we talked about, when we talked about consideration and what some of the arguments were in favor of it, it was to introduce a kind of sense of caution. And writing does that. When you go to put something in writing, you know somehow it feels more serious than when you're discussing it. Okay, so there are some very good reasons to put things in writing. What are some of the reasons why people don't put them in writing?
Maybe they want a little more flexibility than having that written word.
Yeah, the opposite side of the coin, right? The opposite side of the coin of clarity is flexibility.
Maybe too time-consuming and expensive in some ways?
Well, the transactional costs are going to be greater if it's going to be in writing. It's going to take more time to do it. It may require hiring someone else to do it for you. That's how lawyers make a living. So we hope sometimes it does that.
They may not know that they should put it in writing. Like, for example, if they're new to the whole bargaining situation, they may just assume that you don't have to come up with...
Well, that's a problem we'll see with the statute of frauds, yeah. But I meant just in general, why do people, as they work, just not put things in writing? Why are they content to do it orally?
Well, sometimes if you're dealing with your friends or family, you think a handshake is good enough because you have that good feeling
that's
of getting
right.
into a contract.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of awkwardness, and it's not just when you're dealing with your family. It's two business people who do business all the time together, who know each other well, then suddenly one says to the other, okay, well, I think I want that in writing. Oh, you don't trust me anymore. Just in terms of social exchange, requiring something, demanding that it be in writing, saying, well, we should put it in writing, although it's nice because it increases caution, it may also impose distance. It may impose a kind of unwanted formality. Well, for whatever reason, obviously, agreements are made all the time and they're not put in writing. On the other hand, one of the benefits, if we say, okay, well, it's beneficial to put them in writing, that necessarily brings you to this question. If people have put their agreement in writing, and then we've now agreed that there are a lot of good reasons to encourage people to put things in writing, if they put it in writing, and then it comes before the court, will we enhance the encouragement of writing or discourage the writing? If the court says, okay, well, I'm glad you've done a writing, but to find out what you've really agreed upon, we're going to have a week of testimony telling us about all the conversations that you had leading up to the moment that you think you reached agreement. Now, if the court does that encourage, discourage writing, or have no impact?
I think it discourages it, because why bother if they're not going to use it anyway?
That's, or at least so courts have thought, right? So one of the arguments, at least, in favor of the parole evidence rule has been, look, it's a good idea for people to put their agreements in writing. We're not going to require it, except in a few cases, but it's a good idea that they put it in writing. And we should honor that writing. We should respect that writing, partly as a way of encouraging. Now, there are other good reasons to respect the writing. Some of the things we've talked about. It's more likely to be clear, clearer than people's recollection. More accurate than their recollection, and more trustworthy than their recollection, maybe. But what we can say about this is that if we really want to encourage people to go to the time and effort of putting things in writing, we're going to have to show it some special respect when it gets to court. That, at least most people think, is the origin of the parole evidence rule. Now, it's not its only origin. There's no doubt about the fact that some of it was in the belief that if people put it in writing, that the cautiousness of the court, not being led astray by the impact that witnesses may have on the jury or on the court, on the judge, having something concrete in writing was the safe way. It felt right. It, among other things, after all, if we say that the oral testimony is irrelevant, well, I can save a lot of time in my courtroom. If I say that, oh, well, I'm going to hear all of the conversations that occurred before this writing, I'm really inviting a more complicated, lengthier trial, which will then require sorting out who's telling the truth or who's saying it more accurately and who's not. And it may, in some way, taint my ability to interpret the agreement, and that's my job. I'm the judge. I get to interpret the agreement. We saw that interpretation was a question of law, more or less. The parole evidence rule, in its clearest, barest form, says that if parties have put their agreement in writing, two things are true. Number one, they may not introduce evidence which contradicts the writing. Number two, they may not introduce evidence of an agreement which, if they still adhere to it at the point that they put it in writing, it should have been in the writing. We would have expected it to be in the writing. Now, these two are very different. They're very different in their scope, very different in their impact. But notice what they include and don't include. We're only talking about an agreement that's been put in writing. We're only talking about words that were exchanged, by the way, orally or in writing, before the execution of this final contract. We're not talking about things which were said afterward, either orally or in writing, about the contract. We're only talking about things that were said or written before the signing of the contract. Number two, the courts don't agree on what the word contradict means. And we're going to have to explore what do we mean contradict. There are at least two possible meanings, probably many more. One of them, contradict, means saying the opposite. So I say, oh, it's really cold out tonight. You say, no, it's hot. Apart from being wrong, you would be contradicting me. We understand that as a contradiction. But inconsistent, that's a tougher one. Inconsistent. In a certain way, anything which varies from what's in writing is in some sense inconsistent with the writing. So you got a wonderful example of the problem of what we mean by contradict and what we mean by inconsistent in Mitchell versus Lath. So in Mitchell versus Lath, you have a deed selling property. It does what all deeds do. It says who the seller is, who the buyer is. It describes the property in meets and bounds. States the price that the buyer is going to be paying. It's a deed. After the property is transferred, the parties get into a squabble. The buyer says, hey, across the street from my house, there's a really awful, dilapidated-looking ice house. When we were negotiating, the seller and I, about my acquisition of this property, I said, I hate that ice house. It wasn't on the property I was buying, it was across the street from me. But it was property that was under the control of the seller. And the seller said to me, I'll take the ice house down. Not a word of that in the deed. They then wrote the contract for the sale of property. There was a deed transferring the property. Not a word about the ice house. Buyers peeved. The buyer brings an action against the seller saying, you have to tear down the ice house. I want a court order requiring you to tear the ice house down. And the attorneys for the seller say, you cannot testify about a conversation that was about the sale occurred before the parties signed the contract of sale. You can't do that. Parole evidence rule. But one of the reasons you can't do it is that it's inconsistent with it. It, in a way, contradicts it. Now, if we had to make an argument that it contradicts, in what sense could we argue? How would we argue that this business about an ice house, which is simply not mentioned in the contract for the sale of the property at all, how can we argue that it contradicts the agreement to testify, hey, they said that they were going to tear the ice house down as part of our deal?
Well, in the writing, it says that in consideration for whatever the buyer's paying, they're going to convey the land. But according to this oral testimony, they're both saying that, and they're saying they're going to tear down the ice house. So it's two different obligations on the part of the seller.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. We say there's consideration. What is the consideration for? The written agreement makes it perfectly clear. The consideration for the purchase price being received from the buyer, the consideration is the conveyance of the property. That's what the agreement says. Now you're saying, oh, no, no, no. The agreement was that the seller had to both convey the property and tear the ice house down. And that contradicts the statement of what the consideration was for in the written agreement. So it contradicts. If the standard were not contradicts but inconsistent, it gets a little harder. And there you notice that the New York Court of Appeals suggests another standard. And the standard is put two different ways. And every time I read it, I say to myself, these don't sound the same to me. One of the ways in which the court described this test, the so-called third test, the first test is collateral informed, but that's easy to me. It's always collateral informed. That is, we're saying, well, you promised me you would do this. It's a separate promise, so it's collateral. And the second one is inconsistent. The third one, the test is said to be, would ordinary people, in an ordinary circumstance such as this, omit this promise from the writing, even though it was still part of the deal at the time they signed the writing? And as to that standard, you notice there's a disagreement between the majority and the dissent by Judge Lehman. Judge Lehman says, oh, I agree with all the standards. You're right. Those are the standards. Those are our standards in the New York Court of Appeals. But you're wrong about your application of the standard to the rules. The standard is, could ordinary people have omitted this even though they still intended to adhere to it at the moment they signed the contract, which doesn't mention it? What's Lehman's argument? Why does he think people could ordinarily have omitted this even though they were still, that it was still part of their deal?
That if they made that oral agreement, they would assume that it would be understood as part of the written, that they wouldn't have to spell it out. That they wouldn't
But how do we know that? What reason would you omit it? I mean, that, because couldn't you have included it? I mean, it was part of the deal after we just said that it says the consideration that here's what you're doing for my money. And then shouldn't it say the two things that the seller is doing?
Well, but it seems like he's saying that if you don't need to, if you've made that oral agreement, it wouldn't seem like it would need to be spelled out.
I think that Lehman actually has a more compelling argument than that, not just you don't need to.
Well, he says it's, doesn't he say that it's not inconsistent because it involves not the land that's the subject of the transaction, that it involves other land?
Okay, yeah, he says, what is this writing? Right? What is this writing? This writing is about a transfer of a piece of land. It's a very formal document. And the deed, same thing. These are formal documents with respect to a transfer of a particular piece of property. This was an agreement that had to do with a different piece of property. It's true that it was part of the deal because the buyer said, I'm not going to buy it if I have to look at that ice. They were buying it, you know, this is property for vacation and they don't want to. By the way, do you know what an ice house is? I got some people here, I'm sure, from rural New England. I always have. That's one of the. During the winter, the way in which you kept things cold in New England is that after the lakes froze, you would go out, or some people would go out, with saws, and they would cut big chunks of ice. They would haul them back, usually using teams of horses or oxen. They'd haul them back to a little shed, which was full of sawdust to act as an insulator. And they would dump the big chunks of ice in that as the winter went on, you would go out and you would chip some of the ice and bring it back and put it in what was literally your ice box. That was how you kept your food cold during the winter. These were not terribly well constructed buildings given the use to which they were put. They weren't well cared for, and with the advent of electricity, in particular rural electrification in the United States, everybody stopped using it. It was an enormous amount of manual labor, and of course it only worked when you had good cold winters. And so these sheds tend to just fall apart. So this was one of these falling apart ice houses, and they wanted it down because it was ruining the view, which I can certainly understand. So Lehman says, look, this was a writing which only had to do with the property that was being conveyed. The agreement had to do with a piece of property that was not being conveyed. And therefore, it's not surprising that it didn't get included. It's not the thing, kind of thing you would have included in a purchase and sale agreement. Maybe if there was some personal property that was being in the house, remember those famous fireplace and the porch furniture? If it was some personality that was being transferred along with the house, you'd expect that to be in the agreement. But this had to do with taking an ice house down on an entirely different piece of property. Nothing that was being delivered to the buyer. So he felt that that last standard was not met. But the trick here is to go back and see how the majority decided to interpret that standard. How does the majority decide when it goes to look at the standard of would people ordinarily have included in the agreement? In that same statement of the third element, what other test does he include? And it's in fact the test that this decision is famous for. How does he say we're going to find out whether that test is met, test number three? He says he thinks they probably violated test number two, but he doesn't decide the case on that basis. This was his way, frankly, of getting around the dissent. So he lands it instead on test number three.
Isn't he just kind of like looking up the writing and just saying, well, this looks like a writing where people would include everything in. He's not looking at their intent.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. This was what was called what became known as the four corners test. Right? I look at what's within the four corners of the piece of paper on which it's written. And if it looks complete and smells complete and feels complete, then it is complete. Well, hey, if it's complete, then there can't be anything else. So I start out with a standard which says, well, could people ordinarily leave this kind of thing out and still agree to it? And then instead, I find my way toward the application of that standard by using a test which says, I'll only look within the four corners of the document and it feels absolutely complete. This one sure does. Therefore, we can't look any further. And that's test number three. In a way, what Lehman does is he rejects the four corner test. And he says, this is not the right way of finding out whether or not ordinary folk could, in fact, leave this out while still agreeing to it. Now, there's a problem with his stance. And here's the problem. How do we know? How do we know about this? Majority's view, the court never will know. Notice the oddity about the parole evidence rule is that it operates through the mechanism of evidence. That is, it says what may not be introduced before the court. But it's not an evidence rule itself. It's really a contracts rule. It's a substantive contracts rule, not a procedural evidentiary rule. How is Lehman, if I'm applying Lehman's test, I'm a lower court judge, and I say, gee, I read Lehman's dissent. I still can't follow it because it's dissent, but let's suppose the Court of Appeals the next year reverses Mitchell versus Laugh and says, no, Lehman was right. We're going to apply the Lehman test. How does that lower court find out about what else was said? After all, Lehman depends, doesn't he, on knowledge of the fact that there were conversations between the seller and the buyer about taking the damn ice house down. If you're sitting there where the majority is sitting there with its fingers in its ears, it doesn't know about that, won't hear it. Nope. Don't tell me anything about happens. Anything happened before you wrote this, because I look at the writing and it's complete on its face. So you can't tell me about anything else, because that's the parole evidence rule. And Lehman says, well, but if what they're talking about is something that they could still have believed was part of their agreement and yet not included it, and there'd be some really good reason for their having done that, then the parole evidence rule shouldn't bar it. Because that's test number three of the three parole evidence rule tests. But what does that mean to the trial court? What does the trial court have to do? How does it behave differently under a Lehman approach than under an approach of the majority?
What they'll do is they'll listen to the information, and then they'll decide based on what they hear if they have to enact the parole evidence rule.
That's right. This test requires that you entertain what is, for all intents and purposes, evidence. I mean, you may hear it informally, so it may not be part of the record that you're making yet, but nevertheless, the judge has to be apprised of, has to learn about these conversations in order to know that there were such conversations. And then the judge will have to decide, well, now that I know about those conversations, do I think they should be allowed to be included in evidence or not? That is, should I apply the parole evidence rule to bar them? Or is this the kind of stuff that the parole evidence rule does not bar? Because it's the kind of agreement that parties may have reached and still believed in, even though it was not included in their final writing. Now, this is a problem that inheres in all the approaches to the parole evidence test, other than the one that Judge Andrews took in the majority of Mitchell versus Law. The only way of avoiding the dilemma, I think it's something of a dilemma that I just described, is to take the view that he took. Of course, the problem with it is that it does somehow feel wrong. That is, if we say that the underlying goal of all adjudication of contract disputes is to start by looking and understanding the intention of the parties and then measuring their performance against the intention of the parties, if that's what we're trying to do, then an approach which says, well, all I'm going to do is look at the four corners of the paper, I'm not going to go beyond that if it looks complete, then in some instances, at least, you've got to know that we're not going to be carrying out the intention of the parties. It assumes a kind of perfection that doesn't exist in real life. It assumes that when people sit down and write out an agreement that looks very complete, that it is going to be complete. And there are at least two reasons why it's not. Number one is oversight. That is, people just sort of forgot about it. And the second one is that somehow or another the parties thought about it but decided for whatever reason that it didn't belong in the agreement they were making. And we're going to see various instances as we go through this chapter of what you might think about that. Whether you'd make the same judgment or not as the parties made about whether it belonged in the agreement that they were writing. Now what's happened is that over the years is that there have been two major strains of evolution of the parole evidence rule. And happily or unhappily for us, they really each carry the name of a famous scholar of contracts law, Wigmore and Corbett. And so we see the way in which they approached and the differences in their approach. Incidentally, for those of you who want to become a little bit of legal historians, one of the ways to track this is to look carefully at the provisions in Restatement of Contracts, first on the subject of parole evidence rule, and then look at the language in Restatement of Contracts, second in the parole evidence rule. And what you will discover, what you will discover is that Williston's view, which dominated the parole evidence rule in Restatement of Contracts first, but it's Corbin's view, which dominates the parole evidence rule as spelled out in Restatement of Contracts second. You know, what a difference 60 years makes. And the Corbin view, and we're going to be reviewing it in detail, is the one that predominates. The principal difference between the two is really one of degree, I think, rather than of central concept. I think that if you take a look at Restatement First of Contracts, that's on page 592, which we printed for you by the authors of the case book, if they assume you'll have Restatement Second but not Restatement First. This is an effort, and it's an effort which I think really does reflect Williston's view. An agreement is integrated. Integrated. What does the word integrated mean? An agreement is integrated. What did you think it meant when you read this language as you prepared for class?
Everything's included.
I mean, we use the word integration has many uses.
Final.
Final?
In writing.
All that the word integrated means here is there's a writing. That's all that it means. Say to yourself, why don't they say a writing? Well, it's because parole evidence rule is very old and this is the way people used to talk. An agreement is integrated when the parties thereto adopt a writing or writings. So they're defining it. Integration simply means a writing or writings. Notice it can be more than one. You can have an exchange of letters in which the two letters together represent an integration. If, in fact, they appear to the court to be a writing that they've adopted as the final expression. Now, notice that in Restatement First, it says adopt the writing regs as the final and complete expression of the agreement. An integration is the writing or writing so adopted. And after you get that definition, you then get the parole evidence rule itself. The integration of an agreement makes inoperative to add to or to vary the agreement all contemporaneous oral agreements related to the same subject matter and all prior oral or written agreements relating thereto. And then you have the notion of partial integration, where there is integration of part of the terms of a contract. Prior written agreements and contemporaneous oral agreements are operative to vary these terms only to the extent as if the whole contract had been integrated. And then finally in 240, an oral agreement is not superseded or invalidated by a subsequent or contemporaneous integration or a written agreement by a subject integration, blah, 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 if the agreement is not inconsistent with the integrated contract and is made for separate consideration or, you'll see this one, you'll know, remember this one from Mitchell Burr's lab, is such an agreement as might naturally be made as a separate agreement by parties situated as were the parties to the written contract. Now, notice that A or B, okay? A or B. So, if you will, these are the exceptions, right? So, what we learn is that if you've got a writing, in restatement first contract, you have a writing, and the writing looks as though it's the final and complete expression of the agreement, then you're not allowed to introduce any prior oral or written exchanges by the parties to vary the terms of the agreement in any way. But 240 says if that testimony that is being offered about a promise that was made that was not in the writing, if you could show it was made for separate consideration, fine, you're allowed to introduce it. Or it is an agreement as might naturally be made as a separate agreement by parties situated as were the parties to the written agreement. Now, you can do that, notice, only if you look at one itself, only if the agreement is not inconsistent with the integrated contract. So, first I decide that I have an integration. I decide that based upon whether or not it looks to be a final and complete statement of the party's agreement. If I do have that, then I'm not allowed to introduce any evidence whatsoever to vary the terms of the agreement. But if it's supported by separate consideration, or if it's an agreement that parties might naturally have made and yet not included in the writing, then to the extent that it's not inconsistent with the writing, it's admissible into evidence. Now, this was pretty much the approach that the court had taken in Mitchell versus Lath, except that you notice it doesn't adopt the four corners approach. Now, what did Corbin want? Corbin's view was, like Lehman's view, or Lehman didn't quite say it, but it's certainly the implications of Lehman's view, that we're not going to know how to respond to the question of whether or not this really or is an integration. Well, we know it's an integration, it's writing, but what is an integration of? We're not going to know that without hearing testimony, without hearing what it is that the parties did and said before they signed the agreement. We're just not going to know. And he said, you know, in any event, let's face it, integration simply means it's a writing. And the real question is it a complete integration or not? Because after all, it could be a partial integration. And by partial integration, he meant, and you'll see this in restatement of contract second, by partial integration, he meant that it's an integration of what it is an integration of. So the writing covers certain elements of their agreement. If it covers all of the elements of their agreement, then it's called a complete integration. But if it covers only some parts of their agreement, then it's a partial integration. We'll find out whether it's a partial integration or a total integration, complete integration, by listening to the testimony of the parties who talk about what it was that they said or did during the negotiation of the agreement. Without that, we won't know. Then Corbin said, whether it's a partial integration or a complete integration, one thing is certainly true, and that is that you cannot introduce any evidence that is inconsistent with the writing or contradicts the writing. If, however, it's a partial integration, you can introduce into evidence of promises which are not inconsistent with the writing. Once you've decided it's a partial integration, you've acknowledged that there were other things that the parties agreed to, and those can be introduced into evidence. But they can't contradict or be inconsistent with the writing. So that's the scheme that Restatement Second of Contracts is using. Well, you have this dilemma. It's the dilemma which really is inherent in Lehman's view. How am I procedurally going to do this? So here's what the courts do. I have a contract dispute. Complaint, contract usually attached to the complaint. The defendant in the answer says, but that's not all we agreed to. Or the plaintiff and the complaint could say, here's the contract, but it's not all we agreed to because the defendant also agreed to do this, which he hasn't done. The judge says, well, this is a parole evidence problem. I have to decide whether or not evidence of what the plaintiff or the defendant are now talking about as things that are not in the contract but are part of the deal, I'm going to have to decide whether or not there's going to be testimony about that. So what I better do is this. Outside of the hearing of the jury, I'll have those witnesses come in and tell me what it is that they have to say. I can have the lawyers tell me what the witnesses are going to say, or I could have the witnesses come in and say it, and I'll listen to it. Then, if I decide that, yes, this is really a partially integrated agreement, and I think that what they're talking about is probably not inconsistent with what's in the writing, therefore, the parole evidence rule doesn't bar it, okay, now those same witnesses could come into a trial with a jury impaneled, and the jury will hear the testimony. Not the height of judicial efficiency, obviously, and a pain in the neck if you're a witness, particularly a non-party witness. But it's what you have to do, because after all, if you allowed the jury to hear the testimony about what was said before, then the judge instructs them, oh, ignore everything you heard about that other agreement because that evidence is barred by the parole evidence rule. Reminds me of a cartoon that the New Yorker ran years and years and years ago, in which you have the judge and the lawyer and a sketch, and you have the jury, and every member of the jury's face is distorted in a vision of having experienced total horror. And the judge is saying, oh, the jury will ignore that last statement by the witness. So we do it outside of the hearing of the jury. Of course, then the next question comes, yeah, but how about if this is a case being tried to the judge? We say, oh, well, that's all right, the judge can wipe it out of his mind. Maybe. As we look at these cases, the question you ask yourself is, which would be better? Which approach? The extreme, that's Judge Andrews in the New York Court of Appeals, Four Corners Test. The more moderate view, which is the Williston view, or the more lenient, liberal, progressive, whatever term you want to use, which is Corbett's view. Most courts in the United States today are over where Corbett is. The fact that they're over where Corbett is suggests something very important about the judicial attitude toward the parole evidence rule. And that is that they think that on the whole, it probably has the potential to do more harm than good. Why? Because it may exclude evidence of the real intention of the parties in courts that I think are deeply committed to the notion that what they're there to do is to carry out the intention of the parties. On the other hand, for lawyers who go through lengthy negotiations, their clients do, they do with them, and who want the kind of clarity that they think they can achieve in writing an agreement, it's really quite frightening to think that all of that work could be for naught, that you will still be confronted with a lengthy trial in which you'll be hearing tales told about, well, they said this during the negotiation, and we said that, and they said this, and we said that, and you're sitting there saying, a lot of things are said during negotiation. What counts is what we finally agreed to and put in writing. That's why we put it in writing. The response, the way in which lawyers have tried to deal with this, and we'll look at some of these too, is called a merger clause. That is, we try to introduce into our writing language which says, hey judge, this really is the final and complete expression of the agreement of the parties. This, don't listen to anything else, judge. And we're both signing this statement. And then you hope that the court will look at that and say, well, we do have the parole evidence rule. This is a carefully written document. It does have this clause signed by both parties, which say that this really does represent the totality of what they agreed to, and that there aren't any other agreements that they have other than the ones that are in writing. We should honor that and therefore exclude the evidence based on the parole evidence rule. Okay, let's see how some of this works out. Let's take a look at Masterson versus Sine. You notice the name of the judge here, Judge Traynor. He was the same judge who brought us Drennan versus Star Pavitt. At this point, you notice in 1968, he had become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of California. I don't know whether you can follow this case or not. It was a conveyance of property by Dallas Masterson and his wife, Rebecca. The statement tenants in common means they held it jointly. They owned it jointly. That's all it means. So they convey to Medora and Lucine the property saying, quote, reserving unto the grantors herein an option to purchase the above described property on or before February 25th, 1968. Signed agreement was signed that same day, 1958, so it's 10 years hence. Quote, for the same consideration as being paid heretofore, plus their depreciation value of any improvements grantees may add to the property from and after 2.5 years from this date. And we're told that Medora is Dallas's sister and Lou's wife. Dallas is adjudged a bankrupt. The trustee in bankruptcy wants to execute this option. So It's an option agreement. They want to execute the option agreement. They want to take the property back because it's more valuable than the cost will be in getting it back under this agreement. And therefore, it is money that is available to the creditors of the bankrupt. And that's being resisted on the theory that the parties understood that this option was personal to Dallas, or Dallas and Rebecca. That was the option. The option was an option that was personal to them. Only they could exercise it. And I don't know whether this was clear or not, but as a general proposition, contracts law assumes the assignability of everything. We'll learn more about this maybe if we reach the law of assignment at the very end of the year. That the general default rule in contracts law is that everything's assignable. So you have an option, that the option could be exercised by Dallas. If the option could be exercised by Dallas, it could be exercised by anybody to whom Dallas conveys it. In this case, he didn't willingly convey it. It got conveyed to the trustee in bankruptcy under the bankruptcy law. So, as a general proposition in law, this doesn't say that there are restrictions on the exercise of who can exercise the option. The intention of the desire on the part of the Masterson is to induce the court to accept testimony that part of the option agreement was that it was to be personal. That is, that only Dallas could exercise the option. What's Trainer's analysis? What kind of test is he applying here to decide whether or not this can be introduced into evidence or not? The decision, you notice, annoyed the hell out of Judge Burke, as you could probably tell by this fairly snippy dissent on page 599. Well, let's start out with what the easy part. Okay? Were there some parts of this in which parole evidence was, in the view of the court, introducible? All the court, even Burke?
Of depreciation, that the term, even though it wasn't explicitly in the contract, it was defined by the IRS code, and also the amount and the cost of the sellback based on the purchase price.
Yeah. Now these two, notice, are both in a class that we're going to talk about on Thursday night. Are these new promises?
No.
Or qualifications of the promises? What are they?
They're kind of just defining.
Yeah, they are interpretations of the language used by the agreement. And while the court doesn't make a clear distinction here, we'll see that courts really handle somewhat differently the effort to introduce evidence of prior oral or written exchange where that evidence is being introduced for the purpose of clarifying what is otherwise uncertain or ambiguous language. That somehow is different than the way the parole evidence rule is used to determine the introduction of an alteration in promises. So the court does, and Burke agrees with those two. It's no problem at all. It's the third one that's the troublesome one, right? This is the third one, and the third one, after all, is one which is the one, crucial one here. It's the one that says, oh yeah, this option is exercisable only by Dallas. Okay, so now we're up to his part. You say, well, he uses a kind of Corbett approach. Well, what test does he? He talks about what kinds of tests he should use. What does he end up using?
I'm not sure if this is exactly it, but one of the issues he mentions is whether the information is likely to mislead the fact finder. Then if it is, then it cannot be admitted.
How do we know whether it's going to mislead the fact finder when we don't know what the facts are? What does mislead mean? You see the dilemma here.
Right.
I mean, would it mislead? I mean, it would lead a, listening to testimony will lead a fact finder to say, oh, this was a personal option, not a, but that could be misleading if in fact that's not true. And the agreement doesn't say, oh yeah, it can only be exercised by Dallas. But that doesn't address what I'm asking in any event. What I'm really asking again is what standard? That is, this is an area that is fraught with difficulty in defining the standard. How do I know what the rule is for what the parole evidence rule should be taken to include to it, or exclude?
Well, they talk about that the contract doesn't say it's complete, so it's possible that it's not.
Okay, look at that. What he does is he makes reference to Section 2-202 of the Informed Commercial Code. Now, you notice that this is not a sale of goods, right? This is a real estate transaction, an option in terms of a real estate transaction. So what can you say about this? Well, first of all, of course, one of the things you could say is that Judge Traynor was an active member of the American Law Institute. He was one of the people who helped write Section 2-202, and he obviously likes it. But it's interesting to, but it also shows you the impact, not just in California either, that the Uniform Commercial Code has had in distinctly non-Uniform Commercial Code cases. Because it's taken, it appears to be a carefully thought through codification of contracts law. True, only technically applicable to sale of goods, but nevertheless, a coherent, fairly coherent statement of law, of codification of the rules of law. So take a look at 2202. You have it. Was it sort of like the restatement, but not exactly like the restatement? It starts out sounding very much like the parole evidence rule we've been talking about. Terms with respect to which the confirmatory memoranda of the parties agree, or which are otherwise set forth in a writing intended by the parties as a final expression of their agreement, with respect to such terms as are included therein, may not be contradicted by evidence of any prior agreement or of a contemporaneous oral agreement, but may be explained or supplemented, A, by course of dealing or usage of trade. Talk more about that on Thursday or next Monday. B, by evidence of consistent additional terms, by evidence of consistent additional terms, unless the court finds the writing to have been intended also as a complete and exclusive statement of the terms of the agreement. And you see on page 597, his reference to this. He says, the draftsman of the Uniform Commercial Code would exclude the evidence in still fewer instances, and then quotes this additional language, and he puts in italics the word certainly. So what it does, it establishes a kind of presumption, if you will. That is, when I'm looking at an integration, when I'm looking at a writing, a confirmatory memoranda, I should understand that it is the final statement of the agreement with whatever it states. But I should not assume that it is an effort to include everything they agreed to, unless I have very specific evidence that they intended it as a complete and exclusive statement of the terms of the agreement. So that is, requires some kind of special proof that would invoke the pristine, complete parole evidence rule and bar the introduction of evidence. So that's his standard. He says, look, I am not going to assume, based upon the fact that this agreement is in writing, I'm not going to assume that it was intended to be the complete agreement unless there's something special said here that compels me to find that this was the party saying, hey, this is the complete and exclusive thing that we've agreed to. It's all that we've agreed to. And then, on page 598, he does something that some courts would still disagree with. He says, oh sure, I understand that our general default rule is that if an option is created, that it's assignable. And I understand that the testimony that is offered now is testimony that would directly contradict that default rule. But you know, so what? It's just a default rule. We're not contradicting something the party said. We're contradicting something that we would have inserted as a kind of gap filler. Since the parties didn't say one way or the other, we would say it's assignable. But if the parties are now testifying that they said it was not assignable, well, then there's no room for us to be filling a gap because there's no gap. This is a very controversial position among the courts. Some judges will say, look, when you don't include time, place, price, assignability, if you don't include those things, we have rules of law that fill in. And those fill-ins are the same as agreements the parties make. And if now the effort is to introduce testimony which contradicts those, you can't do it. You can't do it. Notice one other thing about the 2202. Remember I said there's some doubt about whether or not we're talking about things that contradict or things that are inconsistent? In the principal section, 2202, the word that's used is may not be contradicted. But in 2202B, it refers to evidence of consistent additional terms. Well, between the word consistent and the word contradict, there is a big area of things that may be thought to be inconsistent with, but not contradictory. And we have no idea where they fall within the terminology of the 2202. I don't think that was just carelessness. I think it reflects compromise within the, what shall I say, the legislative process within the American Law Institute and the Uniform Commissioners on State Laws. So, based upon this standard, on what grounds is it introducible? Well, we apply to 202 kind of standard. What are we looking for? What finding do we need to make if we're going to conclude that it's introducible? What findings, plural? If I'm applying this kind of standard that 202 suggests, then what do my findings have to be when I go to apply that standard to the facts? Okay, so that what they are saying does not contradict the writing. That's one.
You could also say that under 2202B, you have evidence of consistent additional terms, which is the information that was intended to be personal. And the writing, there's no evidence that the writing is intended as a complete and exclusive statement.
Okay, good. No evidence that it was intended as the final and exclusive agreement of the parties. Now, he's helped by some things in the facts here. The very things that we talked about and saying, oh, well, you know, that's easy to introduce, the fact that the compensation meant the original price that was being paid, the depreciation and improvements meant something else. He could say, look, this is not a professionally drafted instrument. This does not show kind of careful craftsmanship, if you will, in rendering the agreement. It shows that they were understanding some things that they weren't putting in writing. Or the way they put them in writing meant something to them, but it's something different than it might have meant to us if we had not been informed about what it meant to them. So we had the benefit of having an agreement that was not obviously a complete and exclusive statement. And nothing the parties said about it. That is, there was no merger clause, and the parties didn't say, this is an exclusive and final agreement. And so with that, he felt that the only question he had to answer was the consistency or contradictory question. And he says, well, it doesn't contradict anything in writing. Well, it doesn't contradict it because all that it contradicts is a gap filler provision. It does not contradict anything that's in the writing itself. Okay. Good. Hunt Foods. These folks are in negotiations over the purchase of some stock. The negotiations have to be interrupted. I'm not sure we know exactly why. The potential buyer of the stock says, look, I'm really worried about the fact that we're not going to continue our negotiations to completion right now. This will be a delay, and I'm worried that you're going to sell your stock to somebody else. And so what I want to do is I want us to write out an option that I have to buy the stock and the price at which I would be able to buy it. So they write it out that way, and then they do in fact resume negotiation, but they can't come to agreement about some of the elements of the deal. And so negotiation breaks up, doesn't end up in a new contract being made, and then the buyer executes the option, exercises the option, takes the stock. And they're saying, hey, wait a second. That was an option that you had only as security against my offering the stock to anybody else. I didn't do that. I came back and we continued negotiating. We just couldn't agree. So you no longer have the right to exercise that option. And the buyer said, nah, nah, nah. Doesn't say that. We had something in writing. Parole evidence rule bars you from introducing any qualifications to what is otherwise an unlimited right on my part to exercise the option to buy your stock. And that's what I did. Which part of the parole evidence rule does this court think is relevant to this controversy? Are they arguing here about the question of whether or not this is additional term which, you know, can't be introduced because it's a complete integration? And because it's a complete integration, it excludes testimony of everything. Or are they arguing, well, it's a partial integration, and so it will not, it does exclude anything which contradicts, but it doesn't include anything which, doesn't exclude anything which is consistent?
The latter.
The latter, okay. So this is a battle, again, about the question of what we mean by contradict or inconsistent. Well, if you were representing the party that's trying to, that's insisting on the parole evidence rule and that it bars the testimony, how would you argue this, that particular question? Remember what the agreement says? The agreement says that I have the right to exercise an option to buy the stock at a certain price. And I want to argue that you may not introduce the evidence you're trying to introduce, which is that there were only limited circumstances under which I could exercise that option.
Would them paying $1,000 for the option, would that suggest a, I mean, I know it's consideration for the option, but would that suggest that they had executed? Yeah, I have no idea where I'm going.
Well, actually, their argument is actually, fairly easy in a way. It always is for somebody who's arguing the parole evidence rule excludes it. In what way are they going to say that what the owner of the stock is arguing is contradictory or inconsistent with the written option agreement?
Took the money.
I think you have to look at the statement of the option itself.
Well, I think you would say, okay, well, we agreed to a price, this is what it is. Whatever he's going to say is going to be contradictory to what we agreed to.
Exactly. In the language here, yeah, the language here is unlimited, right? It doesn't say that I can only exercise it under this circumstance or that circumstance or that circumstance. It says that I have an option to buy. And now you're trying to tell me, oh, I don't have an option to buy. I have an option to buy only on these very limited circumstances. If there's, that contradicts what the writing says, which is that I have an unrestricted option to buy. That's what it says. That's the argument. Well, the tough argument is on the other side. The tough argument is, how do you argue then? And how does the court argue the question of whether or not this is consistent with, or not inconsistent with, or not contradictory to?
They not reflect on that because there's the $1,000 additional consideration, and then there's the actual price that's in the option agreement. I mean, what was the $1,000?
Well, but it's not unusual to have to pay for an option. Not unusual to pay for an option, and the option could easily be have all kinds of conditions associated with its exercise. But, you know, without payment for the option, it wouldn't be an option. He's got to pay something, right? Or else it would not be an effective option, because you have to have consideration. An option is a contract that requires consideration.
Doesn't the option agreement contradict the actual negotiations?
Well, nothing happened in the general negotiations. They never came to an agreement.
But they were agreeing to come back to negotiate.
Oh, yeah.
Which, if you...
Well, they agreed to come back to negotiations, and maybe they had even reached the famous point at which an obligation to bargain in good faith had arisen. But there's no argument here that they didn't. They just couldn't agree in the end. It happens.
Well, they have an unconditional option to buy, then what is there to negotiate? Couldn't they just say, I'm asserting my option and I'm taking the stock? If there are other negotiations, then obviously it's not the end of the contract and there are restrictions involved.
So how do I find, how do I argue the consistency, inconsistency, or consistent or contradict argument? Because all you've said is, gee, it doesn't sound as though they had done a very sensible thing in exercising this option agreement when in fact they were in the midst of a negotiation which in the end didn't come to agreement. I think that's absolutely right. It's clearly true. It was a ridiculous, silly, awful thing that they did. They never should have done it. But they did, in fact, create this option agreement and took some money for the option agreement. Now, when they did, of course, in fairness to these folks, they did it, I think, presumably, we're going to accept their testimony for the moment, saying, oh, I can understand why this buyer is worried about this. And this is how the buyer is going to protect themselves against my attempting to peddle my stock to somebody else during this hiatus in our negotiation. I must say that there are other ways of accomplishing this besides creating this kind of option to buy, which does seem to me a little bit extreme. But that's what they did. What does the court say? How does the court define the term inconsistent in order to be able to find that this is not inconsistent?
The court finds inconsistent as meaning it negates the term of the writing. So it's not inconsistent because it doesn't negate that they have an option.
Right. Okay, that's the point. The point is that the court says, look, by inconsistent or contradictory, what we mean is the language that is proposed to be introduced into evidence negates specific words in the written agreement. And there were none. There's nothing that directly contradicts. Now, most courts won't go this far. Most courts will not accept this standard. This goes too far in the view of most courts. The notion that you're going to introduce, because it really means you're going to introduce anything, just so long as it doesn't negate something that the writing says. By that standard, there'd be very little that would be barred by the parole evidence rule. Because almost never is somebody trying to introduce something that directly contradicts. It supplements in some way or another. It alters it in some, here, very basic form. And in Masterson versus Sine, it alters it in some very basic way. But it doesn't negate anything that it says.
So do you think it's, in this case, the court is trying to make sense of, sort of like what Stacy was saying earlier, the whole thing doesn't make any sense to have this option, so this is the only way that it could make sense?
That may be some motivation on the part of the court doing it, but it's not what the court does. I mean, it's not what the court says. What the court says is, look, our rule is that you may not introduce, assuming now we're not talking about a complete integration, we're talking about a partial integration, that says that anything can be introduced just so long as it doesn't contradict the writing. I define contradict as meaning negate. There's nothing in the proposed testimony which negates the words. Therefore, it's introducible.
So that's just
it. It has the virtue of being very clear and relatively easy to apply, much easier than the word inconsistent. But on the other hand, it's not clear that that's really an effective rule, effective standard for the parole evidence rule to achieve anything. We'll be back at more of this on Thursday night.